What do you want of me?
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
I'm Joshua.
I'm Pat.
I'm Kelvin.
And this is Get Off My World, live from Convergence. Woo! We're three guys and the occasional guest who love the classic Doctor Who series and try our best to love the new series, too. We'll take you through five rounds rapid and get to the bottom of what's great and not so great about our favorite show. And today, our special guest is local artist and geek girl extraordinaire, Ariel Leaf.
Well, hello.
Hi, Ariel.
It's really awesome that you're here to provide some womanly insights and pregnant womanly insights.
Yes,
too.
Yes, so you get two women for the price of one.
We're shaping a life form here today, people, so keep that in mind. We like to kick off the podcast with round one, temporal grace. We can sometimes get a little curmudgeonly about the show we love, so that's like we like to start things off with something that makes us uncharacteristically happy about Doctor Who.
And so, since we're at Convergence, I thought these could all be Doctor Who-related things that we like about Convergence. And I'll start off just kind of generally, one of the things that I like about the con these days, and I've been going since the first year, is just how much more Doctor Who stuff there is. Back in the day, people wouldn't get your Frobisher jokes, Josh.
I still did them. That was the sad part.
But now it's just totally mainstream. If by mainstream you mean Convergence mainstream. So, you know, women in TARDIS dresses and vanity license plates and bumper stickers and all the great hall costumes and stuff. So I'm just getting kind of a nice glow out of that. But you got here like 30 seconds ago, Josh. You haven't been to the convention.
Yeah, I feel nothing for Convergence right now. This is not terribly Convergence related, but I am, if you listen to the podcast, a big Finnish fan. So my current excitement is about the new series who trickling into Big Finish, because they just announced that River Song is going to be teamed up with the Eighth Doctor, a River Song box set separately. They also are doing classic Doctors with the new monsters, so there's a Fifth Doctor Weeping Angels on audio, so I'm very curious how they work on audio. Yeah. But I have faith in it.
Don't hear. Whatever you do,
don't listen.
It'll be interactive. You actually have to pause the CD in order to listen to it. I'm interested to see how Big Finish can then take characters from the new series that they're kind of done with, like River Song, and see what sort of rehabilitation they can do, because they certainly did that for companions from the classic series. And what I like best is I used to think that Big Finish, with some of their box sets, were just kind of desperate because they only had the classic series, so they would do the side characters from Remembrance of Daleks as 16 different box sets and stuff. But it turns out it's just something they like to do, because they've also announced that they're doing a Winston Churchill box set from the new series. That is the weirdest. It's like, you've got the whole new series to play in. And they're like, I want Winston Churchill. Bring me Winston Churchill.
Well, they are British.
You're right. It's like, we, of course, do Abraham Lincoln audios here, but
I suppose Winston Churchill falls into some sort of legalistic category of, like, public domain or something. Like, well, he was a prime minister. We
probably can't copyright Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
Well, what about you guys?
I think that my favorite thing about Doctor Who at Con is probably my favorite thing about Con in general, which is that nobody that I've seen doing any cosplay is perfect and nobody cares. It seems that it's much more the spirit of things here that is what matters, and everybody gets a nod. You know, the kid who wasn't wearing the right David Tennant outfit, but he had the right Converse on, people complimented his Converse. They didn't, you know, rip on him for not wearing the exact right jacket, or they found the thing to compliment and were, like, incredibly positive, and this kid is coming to Con for the next, you know, 35 years. And I think that I've just enjoyed the spirit in general of seeing sort of crossover cosplay. You know, I saw somebody in what was clearly some sort of anime outfit with a Tom Baker scarf, you know, and just the ability to just say, hey, I love both of these things, so I'm going to layer them together.
And our listeners at home can't see this, but Ariel is currently dressed like Ace from The Curse of Fenric, and a good job, too.
Oh, well, thank you. I have made 7 50-year-old men very happy today. I do find myself, you know, a little tear in the corner of my eye when all the girls in TARDIS dresses pass me and they have no idea what's going on. And I think, I wish that the old episodes were more available and more accessible and that people would go back.
Well, we'll post a picture of you online because a lot of girls in their 20s listen to this podcast. Perfect.
It's really big in all girls, high schools,
right.
Art colleges.
Well, why do you think I was begging to come on the show? I want to still seem to be a 20-year-old girl.
I'm not.
Well, Calvin, how about you?
I think I've mentioned in the past that I follow a Twitter feed called WhoSFX, which every so often posts a bunch of images and stuff, behind-the-scenes effects work from Doctor Who, and this kind of dovetails with Ariel being a fan of the 7th Doctor era. They tweeted a bunch of images from behind the scenes of Dragonfire, and I was rather childishly pleased to discover that the effects shot of Kane dying was largely achieved with a blow-up sex doll. Because he kind of melts and shrivels.
Largely achieved?
Largely. Like they basically said, yeah, no, the main component of the model of Kane shriveling and dying was a blow-up doll.
So an inflatable one, not like a...
No, yes, tank. That's why I said blow-up doll.
A blow-up doll.
Not
TNT.
Like not the kind that explodes.
Not packed with JNT. TNT.
I don't want to think of a sex doll packed with JNT. I really don't.
But now I have to.
But... You know, it deflates and he shrinks, shrivels up, and, you know, okay, well, that makes perfect sense. And
I'm not sure it does make perfect sense, Calvin, but that's okay.
I think sometimes the limitations of their special effects makes what they ended up using that much more entertaining.
Yeah.
See, now I want to go back and rewatch the entire classic series and figure out where they're using sex dolls. Yeah, the little tiny sex dolls when the master shrinks people.
Like, I think the Ood are sex dolls. Ooh.
Now, how exactly does this dovetail with Ariel's cosplay?
Well, it's a 7th Doctor era thing.
Oh, yeah, so you didn't see somebody in a Hall costume?
No, I didn't. I'm trying to picture, the dead Kane Hall costume.
Just a puddle on the ground.
Okay, now we're going on to round two, Special Topics Dalek. Since the theme of Convergence this year is dystopias, we thought we would just talk a little bit about how dystopias have been portrayed on Doctor Who over the years.
One of the things that came up when we were discussing this back and forth in email was that a lot of the dystopias in Who are much more World War II Hitlerian and less sort of 1984-ish. But for me, when I was watching it, I did see some of that 1984 element, and I don't know if it's just that particular time period. And having gone to an alternative school that was very anti-authoritarian, I think I was really drawn to some of that 1984 element, and that's part of what made me really enjoy it. And thinking about episodes that do that will lead me to thinking, of course, about one that we've already talked about, which is Paradise Towers. And anything that has that sort of general sense of everything is totally fine, the way the system's running is great, don't question it, but underneath there's something incredibly subversively dark happening. Thinking about the new series... I thought a lot about Planet of the Ood, where you've got these Oods that seem perfectly content to be slaves, but in fact are incredibly unhappy about it and about to start their revolution.
Poor Ood.
Yeah, right, the poor little Ood. But you see that a lot, and I had a question that I'll pose to you, gentlemen, because I may be incorrect, and it was more of a question mark for me. Do you think that the Trial of a Time Lord would qualify as a sort of that sort of a happy dystopia where it seems like, oh, it's all fair, you're at this trial, but really underneath the Valyard is controlling everything.
You could almost argue that, you know, Time Lord society is in and of itself sort of dystopian because they just sort of don't seem to do a lot of self-examination.
Yeah, that seems to be about right.
Yeah.
The whole society is inert
It's built on just not ever doing anything and not changing whatsoever. The Kangaroo Court in Trial of a Time Lord, I guess I wouldn't personally consider it dystopian because it doesn't seem representative of the wider society. It's specifically a Valyard thing targeting Colin Baker.
Sure.
But obviously, dystopia is such a broad concept, and elements of it can creep into a billion different stories.
Oh, yeah.
When I made the list, when I was going through the series and writing down all the ones that seemed to me to be maybe dystopian, I came up with between 50 and 60 of them. It's like a huge number of potential dystopian.
We rewatched all of them before.
Yeah.
Well, what was really interesting when you sent me that was actually me realizing that my definition of dystopia is not the dictionary or general definition of dystopia, because I had always only seen it from that sort of fake happy presentation point of view and not realized how incredibly wide it could be. So when you sent out that list, I sort of had to go back and go, oh, what is it that I think of dystopia? Oh no, it's grimmer. It's even grimmer than that.
Yeah, and when I was compiling the list, I took a real broad view of this is any type of oppressive society. And so kind of by that definition, I don't really think of things like Genesis of the Daleks as being specifically dystopian because it's a military dictatorship under crisis, of which there are a lot of other examples in Doctor Who too. But to me, the idea of dystopia implies some sort of stability, some type of functioning society that is deliberately oppressing people.
Yeah, I definitely would not want to live in Khaled society.
No.
I certainly wouldn't want to live in Dalek society, but Khaled society isn't really an improvement.
Well, and that one is specifically, it's so quintessentially Doctor Who, because Who represents Nazi-like societies a lot. And that one is the most specifically Nazi one that I can think of. And that permeates the entire classic series. And although you're right that there are 1984 Orwellian elements in a lot of the shows, there's at least an equal number of World War II.
Well, and I think perhaps there might be more. I think, maybe it was an era-based thing, or just when I happened to watch it, that was leaning in that direction. But I think a lot of the earlier Who has much more of that World War II, Hitler, fascist warning.
Yeah, the war was less than 20 years over by the time the show started. A lot of the people would have had memories of it, either as adults or children. And so Hitler and the Nazis loom so large as the quintessential evil that it, especially for British society, that it's not really a surprise that it would be so frequently represented on television. Are there more or less dystopias in New Who? I on my list, there's not really very many.
Yeah,
there's less. I think that the New Who is happier.
Gridlock, kind of, maybe.
Yeah, going back and forth on Gridlock.
This kind of boundary hair-splitting stuff kind of drives me up the wall. But, you could almost say Gridlock is almost a post-apocalyptic scenario because the virus that killed the control people and...
It's got the macro in it, too.
And it's got the macro in it.
And macro terror is definitely a dystopian story, yes.
In fact, when I was compiling this list... This is so crazy, but lots of Doctor Who stories depict seemingly stable societies that are secretly run by alien monsters, like Sunmakers or whatever. But the Macra Terror was the first one that did that. So in a lot of ways, the Macra Terror, which we just discussed on our podcast a few months ago, is like the template for a big chunk of Doctor Who. Who would have thought?
Giant crabs informed all of Doctor Who.
So, but yeah, I think you're right, Ariel. I think the new show is just generally sunnier, and there isn't as much of a place for dystopia in the new program. And when there is, like in The Sound of Drums, Last of the Time Lords, when the Master takes over the world, it's immediately retconned out of existence. They literally rolled back time.
Oh, that never happened. The world would never be like that. Forget that existed.
Right, and the only people who remember it existing at all are Martha and the Doctor and Martha's family, and so it becomes emo the way the new series is. Like, they have the terrible memories of the dystopia, but there isn't a society out there that's actually existing in that anymore.
In some ways, you can look at the Doctor himself as this dystopia generator. he's always coming in. He topples some oppressive regime and essentially leaves right when a culture is at its most vulnerable for falling back into some sort of oppressive ways. I'd like a Big Finish story in which we find out that every single oppressive regime in all of space and time started with one toppled regime the Doctor did.
It's like some sort of cosmic level domino theory.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have this inchoate idea that one of the big differences between the classic and the new series is that the people running the show were leftists in a different... They were 1960s or 70s leftists in a way that we don't really see anymore. And so the idea of revolution was a powerful idea at the time. Now, revolution as a political concept, you don't really hear very much in first world stuff. It's mostly human rights issues, civil rights issues, post-1960s. Individual personal politics, and that's stuff that you see represented in the new show. There's no sense that society might need to be overthrown anymore.
I mean, I do think the new series is missing something in not trying that classic format. And I mean, in the new series, it would be probably the Doctor goes back and meets George Orwell and it's some cute shitty thing, and the Big Brother is watching you. No, he's watching you. So I'm surprised they haven't done that.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to look really, really broad, you can say, you know, the old Who was very political. And with that came a lot of leftist opinions and warnings and thoughts. And the new one is a bit more of a soap opera. And it's there to sort of draw in a new crowd and to make you get really attached to the characters. And it's not, I don't feel like it's as much about the stories themselves as it is about the companions and the doctors right. This time around. And for me, that's an element that I miss terribly.
And it's a reflection of the time. I mean, the old show is more interested in history, in culture, and the new series is more interested in individuality, in that it speaks, like, what emotional feelings are you having? How are you identifying with this character? You could be the companion. It sort of is that very personalized social media world. So it is, you know, both products of their time.
You know, he did meet George Orwell in one of the novels.
Yes, I do know that.
Which one was that?
It's History 101 by, is it Mays Halliday who wrote it? I think it's kind of an interesting concept. He meets Eric Blair, uh-huh. who is fighting in the Spanish Civil War at the time.
Oh.
The concept, okay, I'm just going to, it's such a neat setup, I have to go into it. They're in an art gallery in the present day. This is the Eighth Doctor and whoever his companions are, and they view the Guernica, Picasso's famous painting about the Spanish Civil War, and it has no effect on them emotionally whatsoever. And the Doctor's like, this is wrong. Something is strange about this. It has no power. He understands that history has been changed so that there is no truth to Guernica anymore. Something has happened in the Spanish Civil War, so I have to go back to the Spanish Civil War and hang out with George Orwell and see what's going on. So that's a pretty good book. And, you know, I just did a panel on George Orwell at the con 2 years ago.
Yes. Way to merge your two panels together there.
I got to it eventually.
So, that is kind of an odd way to discover, oh, the time stream's been messed with. I don't like this art.
I felt that way a lot in museums.
All right, well then that means we're going to move on to round 3, which is the randomizer. Usually... Oh, that was a special effect sound worthy of the old series. And now, usually the guys discuss a story selected completely at random, but I'm taking over because my favorite doctor is Sylvester McCoy, and my favorite companion is clearly Ace, and our theme is dystopia, so I am making them talk about the Happiness Patrol. And on a very fun side note, my coworker has been borrowing episodes from me, so she's here somewhere at con dressed as a member of the Happiness Patrol.
Nice! I've never seen anyone cosplay the Happiness Patrol.
Really? One of the easiest.
And it seems like it would be a real easy one to do, yeah.
You just need pink hair and some serious gams.
Yeah.
Maybe next year I'll be the Candyman.
A Candyman cosplay would be pretty hilarious.
Oh, just dragging that thing around.
Just yell Gilbert a lot.
that is the number one character options action figure that I want, is the Candyman.
The Candyman. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, so many times I've heard people refer to him as just like the worst villain ever, but I actually didn't hate him watching this.
I love the Candyman.
I kind of love him.
The first time I ever watched the Happiness Patrol, I only saw a chunk of it, and I just saw the Candyman stuck to the floor yelling, Gilbert! And I'm like, and I was just like, what in the hell is going on? And I wound up not watching the rest of it because I was in kind of a downward spiral as far as Doctor Who was at that time.
You want to talk about Conan?
Yeah, but then I went back and watched it later, and like, okay, now I get it. But of course, and I'm sure people are aware of this, the guy who wrote the Happiness Patrol actually intended the Candyman just to be sort of an evil scientist guy who was obsessed with candy.
And not made out of candy.
Yeah, and then the production went the way of making him a candy robot thing. In the novelization, he's described as just being sort of a kind of an older scientist guy who has eyeglasses made out of peppermint sticks.
You know, that's actually creepy.
Yeah.
So you read the Happiness Patrol novel?
No, I've just read about it.
Okay.
There's this thing called Wikipedia.
Well, tell me more. I'd say when I first saw the Happiness Patrol, I was a teenager and I absolutely hated it. I didn't understand why they were taking my very serious Doctor Who and making it silly. Since then, almost every time I rewatch it, I like it more, culminating in this most recent viewing, and I love it to death.
At three episodes, it doesn't overstay its welcome.
No, no.
And yet it's really complex. You don't just have like one enemy or one group of people. You've got the people down the pipes. You've got what's going on in the kitchen. You've got what's going on with the patrol. You have a lot of detail shoved into one single episode, and I think I kind of like that. It always stays alive because there's always somewhere to go to pop to next.
It's surprising. I'll grant you that. For me, it's right on the border. It's everything I hate about this era of Doctor Who. But I can't not love The Happiness Patrol.
Yeah.
Because it's bananas.
Is this one of those ones that was like kind of already in the pipeline before Andrew Cardinal took over? So it's
the Fondant pipeline?
Yeah, so to speak. You know, like he had the story from like the JNT era that he had to kind of cardinalize. So to speak.
I can do this all day.
Yeah. I could be wrong about that. But
I don't know. I don't know too much about the background.
It certainly seems like a further development of Paradise Towers, which to me is more on that line where they couldn't decide. It felt like kids' television. It's all absurd. There's no real threat. Whereas in Happiness Patrol, it keeps that absurd quality, but there's still a sense of danger and a sense of threat while it's still kind of expressionistic. And so I feel like it's the sort of realization of what they started with Paradise Towers but didn't quite nail.
Well, and I think if we're thinking along the dystopia theme, the biggest threat that they warn of in this episode is that even being a party member is not safe. Silas P. goes to bust somebody, but he gets knocked unconscious, and the next thing you know, he wakes up and his own Happiness Patrol is telling him he looks sad and shooting him after he's, you know, been a good Happiness Patrol member, and he's arrested 40-some people and just gotten a badge for it. And so I think that that's sort of the grimmest warning.
Everybody turns into everybody.
Yeah.
Gilbert turns into Candyman. Dennis turns into Margaret Thatcher.
And that is Orwellian. This is clearly one of the 1984 influenced ones, where everybody is spying on everybody else and everybody is going to betray everyone eventually. But it's a really fragile, brittle, like painted brittle dystopia, because it breaks just when you get rid of Helen A.
Yeah.
There isn't really any other structure. So in a way, it's kind of a fantasy if the British left of this period, right? If we could just get rid of Margaret Thatcher, everything would be fine.
Everything would be fine. We could be sad again. And, I mean, the great thing, obviously, it's a parody of Thatcher and the politics of the 80s. Yet, I feel part of the reason it's great is because, like a lot of these sort of dystopian stories that are inspired by more immediate history when they're written, it translates beyond the time period. I think you could watch it today and get a lot out of it and not have to understand that these were jokes about Margaret Thatcher and about Dennis Thatcher. And
yeah, I think the only thing you can't get over watching it now is one of the world's worst puppet dogs.
I love the puppet dog. It fits aesthetically.
I mean, it needed to have been filmed in a little more shadow, I think, maybe. But
I know people have ripped the sets. I love it. The Candy Kitchen, I think, is like one of the best sets they've done. And
the Candy Kitchen is the best set in the show. Helen A's office, I think, is kind of
I like the kitchen. I just don't understand why they filmed all the exteriors on sets.
it all seems to me like they're inside one giant factory. And I as I was watching it, I was like, are they supposed to be outside at any point?
That's the impression I always had.
Like it's a domed city or something?
Yeah, yeah. It's unclear.
I did find it kind of interesting that it's the happiness patrol and it's the compulsively happy society. And it is maybe the darkest, shadowiest Doctor Who story. Everything is in shadow. I mean, apparently, there was this idea at one point to shoot it in black and white. Yeah. They were going to shoot it like a straight-up noir thing.
How weird.
Exactly. And the bright pink seems like a very important
right.
factor.
Right,
and the Candyman.
Yeah, but
the TARDIS was one of the best bits in the whole thing.
But they were apparently that was under discussion, and I guess Sylvester McCoy was like way into that idea, but they, you know, the BBC is like, are you nuts?
And, you it really know. Sounds like a kind of parts of Doctor Who working against one another.
Yeah.
Because clearly the bright colors on the sets would not fit with a noir aesthetic.
No.
And, yeah, I mean, it starts with that blues harmonica being played over the shadowless streets or interiors.
The very opening shot is super noirish, though.
Yeah.
The one sad woman and the trench coat and the alleyway and, yeah.
And nobody's particularly happy, I've noticed, in the happiness patrol. Even the happiness patrol themselves are kind of glum.
Yeah, there's only one woman who's sort of like the second to the top who seems to be getting off on it, but everybody else seems like...
But again, it's not naturalistic. It's very much a fairy tale. It's just a facade. It's like amount of happiness.
Like the one guy playing a slot machine and his... payoff is like a dumb joke.
And he is the
then
joke writer.
Yeah.
and the doctor rips on it. That's one of my favorite parts. He's like, I wrote that.
I remember that confusing me as a kid because they used the British euphemism for a slot machine, which is a fruit machine. because the fruits are the symbols on a slot machine. And I'm like,
oh yeah.
He's not getting any bananas out of it. What? Why are they calling it a fruit machine? I don't know. I brought it to a halt again.
No, I was just having this sort of flashback moment to being 8 and watching Survival, and there's a reference in there to the fruit machine as well. Ace says she's going to go in and get coins out of the fruit machine. And my dad wasn't watching it with me, and I had that same what? How do you get coins out of the fruit machine? Will I find quarters if I eat an apple?
I think there's one in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, too, and so that confused me as a young kid.
I do recall there was one Monty Python thing that refers to a fruit machine, and again, I'm just like, okay, what?
So we're up here at Convergence.
This is actually
talking about our history with the fruit, machine.
This is more important than the actual dystopic themes. Is just like, what the heck is a fruit machine?
One of the moments that I found really striking was the moment in which they've set up the march to come to the forum. And then they turn the events on the happiness patrol because they all pretend to be happy. And so they can't be arrested because they're all laughing.
Oh, right.
And so the happiness patrol people get arrested instead because they're, not very pleased that their prisoners are being let go. And it's sort of the idea that it can turn that fast on a dime. Very similar to when Silas suddenly gets shot. The idea that...
Very unstable.
Yeah.
And anybody can... You can outsmart the dystopia if you just think it through a little bit, like the doctor seems to.
Yeah, that seems to be a theme throughout it, that you just need to talk through it. The doctor has the scene where he talks the snipers out of shooting him, which he was really lucky. His argument was not that sound, but they did not shoot him anyway. But it's a great moment, too, because this episode seems like the sort of halfway point between season 24, Sylvester McCoy, and the darker Sylvester McCoy that's going to come afterwards, where there's that kind of slight dark melancholy undercurrent. He's still goofy, he's still playing his spoons, he still sings as time goes by, which I'm a sucker for. I just find it a really interesting amalgamation of a lot of things that they were trying. My only criticism of it, it seems like something was cut, is the promise of the forum. It feels like a rewrite, like there was a scene. There had to be a scene of the forum, and I just would have loved to have seen Ace telling jokes at the forum, bombing, and people shoot at her. That's in my
opinion. I would have preferred seeing that than McCoy playing spoons again.
You're so cynical, Pat. Spoons bring us joy. Happiness will prevail, Pat.
I feel one of my moods coming on. Final thoughts on...
Well, the only thing that I thought of is that I found it interesting that there's a gender swap here. In most totalitarian regimes that you see, it's men who are in charge,
yeah.
And here it's women, and the snipers are even complaining about that.
Yeah, your women get all the best jobs and the best guns.
Right.
That's a great line. Man.
Yeah, all
well,
of the men in this
we need some little Scottish
incredibly...
guy to come up here and talk us out of shooting him.
Right.
We'll totally be emasculated.
Yeah. Well, yeah, all the men are incredibly subservient to
in
this, and I don't know if
that's a weird
that's
subtext,
connected to the fact that what they're using for their regime is happiness, so it's that sort of fake 50s kind of, like, everything is great, we're all happy in our roles. You know,
well, like the idea that, like, happiness is, like, an inherently feminine attribute or something.
Well, I think it all flows
which
from
is a
the,
little weird
from the Thatcher thing,
right.
Because Dennis Thatcher is such a beta male.
Yeah.
Which is kind of sexist in and of itself. Should be the men in charge. Look at this weird world. Upside down.
Black is white. White is black.
Hey, we should shoot it in black and white. And put a fruit machine in it. That'll screw with their brains 25 years later.
Because that's what the kids want to see. They want to see someone eating a black cherry that actually shows up black on the screen.
Kevin always takes it one joke too far.
I do, don't I? That's my thing.
And today, we present a very special sketch that sensitively explores the generational differences that still cause tension between new and classic Doctor Who fans. Our sketch opens in the family room of a typical suburban home as young Tommy sits happily watching what he believes to be Doctor Who.
I love you.
And I suppose it's my last chance to say it. Rose Tyler.
Tommy, I washed all your underwear, but you'll need to fold... Oh, my God.
Mom, what's wrong?
It's shocking.
What's going on in here?
I don't know, Dad. I was just watching TV, and Mom came in and started screaming.
By the terrible Zoden, what an end space is that?
Doctor Who.
Doctor Who? Son, your mother and I grew up watching Doctor Who, the definitive Doctor Who, produced by Philip Hinchcliffe and script edited by Robert Holmes. We met at a convention in line to get our discontinuity guide signed by Paul Cornell, Martin Day, and Keith Topping. She was dressed as Ace, I was dressed as a Dominator. It was love at first sight. We walked on down the aisle to the theme from Attack of the Cybermen, and we honeymooned in a quarry. You can trust that I speak with great authority when I say that this bastard child of Stargate SG-1 and the unloved 2004 British supernatural drama Hex is not Doctor Who.
Oh my God, what is that awful music?
It's Murray Gold. It's so we know how to feel, Mom.
What? Doctor Who isn't about feelings, it's about a universe where normal human relationships don't apply.
Why is she looking at him like that? No, no, they're going to kiss!
Don't look, darling, don't look.
I don't know how to break this to you, but this is a direct continuation of the old show. Elizabeth Sladen shows up. Even Tom Baker.
Liar!
It's true, you can even see an interview with him on the Blu-ray. Watch.
Oh, God. So old.
That explains it. The poor man has Alzheimer's. He probably thinks it's 1981 and he's still doing Prime Computer commercials with his wife, Lala Ward.
She was so pretty.
You guys are sad.
I'll tell you what's sad. Your mother and I fought for geek rights in the 90s. You grew up in a world free of snuggies and swirlies. A world where geeks didn't have to ride in the front of the school bus. A world in which comic books are taught as literature and genre movies make billions at the box office. And what do you and your generation do with your new demographic power? You flock to retcons and reboots and prequels to every TV show, movie franchise, and comic book our generation holds dear. Sometimes, it's like the wilderness years never happened, and we've crossed a dimensional barrier and found ourselves trapped in Lawrence Miles' weird bottle universe.
Who's Lawrence Miles?
Oh!
He was our Steve Moffat before he went bat-poop crazy. But we'll always have alien bodies,
What's alien bodies?
Classic literature, that's what. Not like the trashy kids call Doctor Who today. Farting aliens, Daleks wearing pinstripe suits, weird implied sex with a paving stone.
All right. I get the point.
Oh, I don't think you do get the point. You new fans congratulate yourselves because your show deals with real-world issues and emotions in an approachable way. That's right, a socially relevant TV series about a scientist slash detective slash man-child who travels through time routinely, I'm so mad right now, commits genocide on rubber people for the love of Verity Lambert. Doctor Who isn't realistic, it's iconic, which is just a polite way of saying we know it's stupid, but we like it anyway. And just as a casting note, if I want to see Barty Crouch Jr. wrestle Sam Tyler from Life on Mars, I'll go online and read some of your mother's slash fiction.
I post on Sidbit.com under the name Barbara Wrong.
What is wrong with you? Russell T. Davies busted his ass to create a show that would appeal to mainstream audiences and still be true to the original series. Oh, hi, Grandpa.
Russell T. Davies, is it? I'm no bigot, but that man's work on Queer as Folk would have given Oscar Wilde the vapors. If I'm going to spend my declining years on a TV show called Doctor Who, I expect one thing and one thing only. Ladies who look nice and pantsuits getting thrown in jail a lot.
But Grandpa, by deepening the companion's complexity, it heightens the Doctor's vulnerability, and we can finally see the pathos at the core.
In my day, TV adventure drama didn't need pathos. If you had a sexy sidekick and an adamant cloak, you were good to go.
Exactly. The Doctor is essentially a cipher, and it took the genius of
Andrew Cardinal. Don't get me started on that pencil neck nerd. He turned Doctor Who into some incomprehensible mishmash of unresolved narrative teases and then tried to make it seem dark and edgy by changing the Doctor's jacket from a light gray to diarrhea brown. But he didn't bother to get rid of the friggin' question mark sweater vest.
No, that was intentional because it really makes the fans.
It was a dumb thing. It's totally. We know he doesn't know anything.
That's it. Everybody, shut the hell up right the hell now. In the immortal words of Colin Baker, it's change and not a moment too soon. People get older, expectations evolve, classic TV shows are turned into slicker modern shows. It's the circle of life.
The cycle of abuse is more like it.
All right, 20 years from now, when Mark Gatiss Jr. starts producing River Song, The Next Generation, I'll be the first in line to bitch about it. What I won't do is barge into my kid's room and start ranting like some big fat geek. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm going over to Johnny's house to watch Star Trek Into Darkness, because no matter what you say,
son,
your father's heart
will always be my Star Trek!
Turn off the TV, Grandpa. I can't look at it anymore.
Okay. Oh! Hey, is it just me or did the master grow some Dalek bumps?
I'm ready. And now, round 5. The Death Zone. In this round, we take two Doctor Who stories or characters from any medium and throw them into the Death Zone to see which one wins. Today, we're doing a special lightning round version of the Death Zone based on, as you'll recall, because you gave them, your suggestions. Our first fight to the death.
Should I read them, Josh?
Why not? That was what the pregnant pause was for. Enemy. Ariel, feel comfortable.
Our first Death Zone battle is between the Rani and the Dalek Emperor.
So we have two versions of the Death Zone, really. One is actually like full-on combat.
And one is like personal preference.
Personal preference. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they go together, sometimes they don't. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that this
like, is a problem. I would think it would be opposites for me. I think in the actual battle I would have to go with the commander, but personal preference would be the Rani.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's like, is this the Dalek Emperor that just kind of sits there with tubes going into him and can't do anything?
Oh, that's true.
Or does he have an army of Daleks?
No. I assume it's just him sitting there. I mean, he's basically a mutant blob in a Cecil environment.
I'm going to go for the Rani both ways, then.
Oh, I got it, too.
I'm going to go for the Rani both ways, too. Wait, what are we talking about?
Well, like, the Rani's supposed to be a chemist. Like, what would she...
Yeah, she's a genetic engineer.
Yeah.
She could...
So the Emperor Dao is just sitting there ranting and raving like a lunatic, and she's just slowly taking him apart.
Yeah, yeah.
You will be... Don't touch that! What are you doing?
Yeah, I think the Rani would figure something out there.
I think we got the Rani on this one. Yeah.
Rani.
Next up, the Cybermen versus the Weeping Angels.
Well, the Cybermen don't blink.
Cybermen it is.
Cybermen have it.
We got rid of eyelids a long time ago.
Cybermen it is. Next up, the Burn Ward Master versus shriveled old David Tennant.
Oh, there's a Big Finish spinoff. Oh.
There's a box set.
Yes, it is.
I would say the Burn Ward Master, despite his decrepit state, seems physically capable of doing things. And yeah. the unnaturally aged 10th Doctor doesn't seem...
He's got the huge sad eyes. The master's about to kill him. And he looks into those.
You're thinking about the gnome thing.
That's what I was thinking.
Okay. I was thinking like the intermediate kind of.
So you think the intermediate stage, unnaturally aged David Tennant might succeed against the Burn Ward Master?
He has a shot.
But the gnome-like thing would not.
No. First, you have to get out of the bird cage or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really want to give it to the Burn Ward Master because he took over Gallifrey, he took over the Matrix, he turned Chancellor Goth into an evil guy, but just because it's Doctor Who is going to defeat the Master, no matter whether he's a naturally aged gnome thing in a birdcage or not. It's like Dobby the House Elf. Next up, K-9 versus Handles. Oh, our old friend Handles. He comes up like every time.
Yeah, I know. Handles is, you know...
Handles has no weapons, though.
Well, he's technically the longest-serving companion the Doctor has ever had, when you think about it.
It's 1,000 years.
Yeah.
Was it K-9 Mark 1, Mark 2, Mark 3?
Well,
Or the Australian spinoff K-9 that's a CGI.
Yeah, Handles hands down in that case. Yeah.
Is that the new one that comes with Sarah Jane Smith? Because I think that one would win.
Yeah, he's always going into other dimensions and like holding black holes at bay or things.
Yes. Yeah. Handles just sits there and humors the Doctor for 1,000 years.
You know, that's probably a pretty effective way to stop someone is just to humor them.
Yeah, it's the slow game for Handles.
Yeah.
So where are we on this? Are we K-9 or are we Handles? I'm going with K-9.
I'm going with K-9.
For personal preference, K-9 and for in a fight, nose gun.
Yeah, if we're doing straight up fight, it's K-9, but yeah.
Madame Vastra versus Captain Jack.
Well, Captain Jack has so many weapons, including his incredibly charming smile.
This is true.
I bet Madame Vastra has some weapons stashed within her person as well.
You know, if we're doing a beauty contest thing, Captain Jack is the prettier one.
He's also immortal.
Yeah.
He can't be killed.
Yeah, how do you stop that?
So he's there for the long game, too.
He can be killed by ratings, apparently, but...
Boy, yeah, I don't know.
I'm going to have to go with Jack because he can come back again and again.
I'm a Jack on this one.
Captain Jack.
I got it.
Well, Captain Jack versus Donna Noble.
God.
We should have just asked him.
I think Captain Jack's just going to give up. He knows his...
That's just an excuse to get fans into a knife fight, I think.
We're not going to fall for your trap.
Adric versus the Candyman.
The Candyman has a more tasteful outfit.
He's got a more charming personality.
If the Doctor couldn't figure out at first that you can just bust open those, you know, little... things holding him down to the chair, then Adric's certainly not going to manage.
Yeah, but I mean, Adric would probably be persuaded to join the Candyman. He's very impressionable and young.
Yes!
He could probably be the new Gilbert. He's like, give me my little pink uniform, Candyman.
The Candyman has some excellent points, Doctor. We need to listen to
him. So I think the Candyman easily has.
Yeah.
Mark Gatiss versus Pip and Jane Baker.
Oh, God.
There's no winners.
I don't
want to
know.
There's no winners here.
Oh, I think Pip and Jane Baker. By a pip. I like Mark of the Rani. Okay? Just back off, people.
Mark of the Rani is an underrated
Gattis is
show
anything,
episode, I think.
As entertaining as that.
Mark Gatiss has done things outside of Doctor Who I've enjoyed.
Yeah, we get a lot of enthusiasm up here.
You know, I'm gonna go with Mark Gatiss.
Wow, based on outside Doctor Who.
Yeah, ancillary projects. Yes.
I'm gonna go with Pip and Jane because I'm a big Ronnie fan as well. Although I'm sort of glad that it's not another thing that's been recycled into the new Who, because I'm just tired of the number of things they've recycled into the new Who.
They'll get there. For a while, there was a rumor that Joan Collins was going to be playing the new Ronnie.
I would pay for which that.
That's intriguing, yeah.
Well, it breaks my heart, but I got to vote for Mark Gatiss.
Wow, I thought this day would never come, ladies and gentlemen. Mark this in your little...
I do like him as an actor. I just hate...
We're not judging him. Or I guess it's fake. You're right.
Don't judge
him.
Yeah,
stop judging me, John.
You know.
21st century autons versus swinging 70s autons.
Cool. Swinging 70s, man.
They're scarier. The new autons are pretty dull.
There's something about the 70s autons when they first come to life and smash through the shop windows. That's still kind of weirdly effective.
Yeah, I remember finding that really creepy, and when that kind of opened the new Who, I was like,
They sort of backed down. It was weird for a 21st century show to be less graphic than something from the 70s. The 70s, they're much scarier.
Those 70s guys can really book, too. We watched Spirited from Space again recently, and there's a scene where he's just running.
And plus, being from the 70s, they have larger lapels so they can glide to safety if they were knocked off a building.
70s autons.
Boom.
Rory the Centurion versus Strax the Centauran. Now, that's Madame Bastra's friend, right?
The butler? The butler. Yes. Yes. The butler guy, yeah. Mm-hmm.
My preference is Rory.
Yeah.
I'm a personal preference.
He's also immortal, right?
Yeah.
He's a Auton. He's a 21st century Auton.
We're talking about Auton.
Yeah, because he's...
Yeah, you're right. He'd also win in a fight, too.
Mm-hmm.
He has...
That would be an interesting matchup. Guy who's been a Roman centurion for 1,000 years versus a Centauran warrior.
He's back to handles in the slow game, man.
You know, yeah, I think we're back to, I think that Centauran could win the first one, but then it would be Rory for the long game.
Yeah. So, a tie.
Captain Jack versus Leela. Everybody wants to fight
Captain Jack to fight, man. He has a sensitive side. Okay, people. Leela.
Maybe she'd just get him to marry her.
Captain Jack would be brooding or standing on top of a building, letting his trench coat billow in the wind, and she'd just stab him.
Yeah. He'd be sitting like, it's the 21st century, and you're going to have to be ready. And then
she'd just be stabbed.
He'd be like, I'm immortal. And she'd be like, well, then I'll just hang you off a cliff for the next 20,000 years.
Jane of Storm.
I'm going to go with Captain Jack on this one just because he can outlive her.
Okay, fine, out of pure outliving, but she would stay there till she dies, just stabbing with that thorn over and over.
She'll go out like a champ. But Rose's mom versus Martha's mom.
Oh. Rose's mom, come on now.
Rose's mom would beat the crap out of Martha's mom.
Yes.
Any
appliance handy.
I mean, I was sort of annoyed by Rose's mom, the character at first, and then Martha's mom shows up and her just withering disapproval thing was somehow more disappointing to me. I don't know, like it wasn't.
That was her only character.
There was a weird moment where I found myself thinking and hoping, and this probably lasted 20 seconds, that Rose's mom was going to become a companion, and I sort of liked that idea. Like, I like the idea of her just like beating him over the head with something throughout time and space.
Rose's mom.
Rose's mom. Rose's mom, yeah.
We've got time for a few more. Weeping Angels versus Jelly Babies.
Jelly Babies don't blink, done. This is Jelly Babies versus Cyberman, two non-blinking opponents. That would be tough.
I don't know if anyone's ever actually eaten a Jelly Baby. They're not actually particularly good candies.
Can you imagine how disappointing that would be as if you grew up as a child with Who and you've been looking forward to that Jelly Baby like for 20 years and you finally get to England and you get that Jelly Baby and it's just sad.
It just sort of tastes like sugary chemicals, and yeah, I don't know.
But do we know that those are the real jelly babies, and maybe they just packed them for Americans who like the jelly baby, like give them the ones in the bottom shelf.
The only time an American wants a jelly baby is because there's some Doctor Who nerd. So
jelly babies fight dirty, they'll win against the weeping.
Yeah, their corrosive artificial ingredients will eat away at the. At the Weeping Angel's stone body.
We have time for two more. All right. K-9 in the original series versus K-9 in the Sarah Jane Adventures. But I think we've kind of covered this.
Yeah.
Because the new K-9 is so much more versatile.
Far more powerful.
Far more powerful.
I think the old K-9 might just run out of batteries.
In preference, I prefer the rickety little wobbly K-9. What's that noise? They hear him coming like a mile away down the corridors.
And so let's end. We have a lot of suggestions for various companion matchups. So let's all just throw them into the Colosseum together.
Oh, wow. This is bloody.
Sarah Jane Smith, Donna Noble, Amy Pond, Leela, Jamie, Frobisher, and Chameleon. And let's just throw Captain Jack in there, too.
Yeah, why not?
No, because he can live forever. That's
okay,
not
we'll take Jack off the table.
Yeah.
Jack is
I'm going to go with Leela then.
Jack's just watching because he likes to watch.
I think everybody else might have some sense of morals or something in their fight, and I think Leela would just come up behind all of them with her thorn.
Well, Frobisher can shape change. That's a heck of a a heck of a power.
I get good odds on Frobisher.
Technically, Chameleon can. But that would involve him moving.
I think one of the most interesting suggestions, the Leela versus Jamie one.
Yeah.
It would actually be a hardcore fight.
Yeah. Ooh, that'd be tough.
That's a classic barroom brawl is what that is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What if it was a drinking contest?
Oh, hey.
Jamie.
But Leela would give it
a good try. Would go down like a champ.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my dream world, again, Leela and Jamie team up and kill everybody else.
Even Sarah Jane?
They eat her.
They eat her. It was like a dark turn.
Oh, I'm sorry. I assume it was like the death zone. There was no food. It was really desperate.
It was all hungry. Games.
Like the actual death zone. Okay.
You want to fantasize a little bit about the weapons they're using? Like polearms and nets and things?
They're bare
teeth
hands.
Teeth and claws.
If it's teeth and claws, then Chameleon might do pretty well.
That's, yeah.
Because they're not going to be able to chow down on him.
You can't eat Chameleon. No.
He can't stand up, though.
Yeah.
No, I'm Leela and Jamie.
I'm going with Frobisher.
Frobisher?
He's my guy.
Fair enough. They also eat Frobisher.
Aww.
That's the death zone.
And that's our podcast. Thank you to our guest, Ariel. And for Convergence for having us, and you, our live audience, who took a shuttle to get here, a space shuttle.
Yeah, let's just pretend it was one of those.
Yeah, that's fine. Please, if you enjoyed the podcast, please visit our website, getoffmyworldpodcast.com, or you can subscribe on iTunes or like us on Facebook. Until then, I'm Joshua.
I'm Pat.
I'm Kelvin.
I'm Ariel.
And we're saying, get off my world.
Thank you, everyone. Yeah.
Let's record another episode.
That's right.